Hello, I'm Christopher Cotter, and what you're about to listen to is one of five podcasts which the Religious Studies Project is presenting in association with the Non-Religion and Secularity Research Network. For those of you who don't know the Religious Studies Project, please take a moment to survey religiousstudiesproject.com, which features a few dozen of our weekly podcasts with leading international scholars on exciting developments in theory, method, and empirical study within the social scientific study of religion. In addition, there are roundtable discussions, book reviews, feature essays, opportunities digests, and more. For those of you who don't know the NSRN, it's an international and interdisciplinary network of researchers founded in 2008, which aims to centralize existing research on the topic of non-religion and secularity, and to facilitate discussion in this area. The NSRN run a series of events, including their biennial conference and annual lecture series, in addition to maintaining a vibrant website with extensive collections of resources, publications, and listings for teachers and students working in the area of non-religion and secularity. You can check out their website at www.nsrn.net. As the Religious Studies Project has a wider remit than this, we didn't want to fill all our listeners' inboxes with five quite lengthy podcasts, and therefore we've not made these available through iTunes. However, they are available on our website and are linked to from the NSRN's website. Due to the lecture style of these recordings, it's somewhat inevitable that the audio quality will be lower than we would like, and that there might be references to PowerPoint presentations or other events happening in the room. However, we know that these will be minor irritations when compared with the stimulating scholarship that you're about to hear, and we're very grateful to the NSRN for working with us to bring you these lectures. This podcast in particular is a lecture delivered by Humaira Iktidar entitled Secularization and Non-Religion in Non-Western Contexts. This was one of the keynote lectures at the NSRN's 2012 conference at Goldsmiths University of London in July. Dr. Humaira Iktidar is lecturer in the politics of South Asia at King's College London, and her research is concerned with exploring the contours of social and political theory, particularly in the South Asian context. She is interested in the shifting demarcations of state and market, society and economy, secularism and secularization. Currently, her work is two key strands. One explores ideas and practices related to tolerance within the Pakistani context. The other engages with the relationship between liberalization and piety in both the UK and in Pakistan. Her recent books include Secularizing Islamists, Jamaat-e-Islami and Jamaat-ud-Dawah in Pakistan, University of Chicago Press, 2011, and also in 2011, a four-volume collection with Routledge, edited with David Lehman, entitled Fundamentalisms, Critical Concepts in Religions. The other four lectures which are available on the Religious Studies Project website are John Landman's NSRN annual lecture from April 2012, entitled Atheism Explained, The Evolutionary Origins of Atheistic Thought, and the other three lectures from the 2012 NSRN conference, Callum Brown on The People of No Religion, Monica Volrapsar on Multiple Secularities Toward a Cultural Sociology of Secular Religious Distinctions, and Grace Davey on Belief and Unbelief, Two Sides of a Coin. For now, I'm going to pass you over to Humaira, who just made it through London's hideous pre-Olympic traffic to deliver a presentation.
Thank you also to the organizers for allowing me this opportunity to work through a concept to some extent. I don't do it in a great detail, but a concept that I haven't necessarily engaged with in much detail earlier, which is the concept of non-religion. So what I propose to do is actually talk a bit about the relationship between the West and the non-West to some extent, talk about secularism and secularization in some depth, because that's primarily what I've worked on in the past, and then also try and work through some ideas about non-religion, particularly in non-Western contexts. So I'll jump right into it, but I must also apologize, this is a litany of apologies, for reading. So periodically I will look up, but mostly I shall read. It's increasingly held that universal application of the terms secularism, secularization, etc. requires a more nuanced thinking than before. There is greater recognition of the fact that Europe's history of secularization is very much its own. the attempt to read into that either a description or a prescription for secularization in other parts of the world is deeply flawed. Yet, of course, this is precisely what was done, and in many cases still done, since the late colonial period onwards. Several scholars have highlighted the fact that nothing quite like the structured, hierarchical Roman Catholic Church existed in other parts of the world, a church that inherited the empire and thus managed the state. There was little need in those parts of the world to wrest control of various functions of the modern state, education, healthcare, warfare, and taxation, because their churches or their versions of religions did not control them, or at least not as tightly. These arguments about the distinctiveness of the Roman Catholic Church and its relationship to democracy, secularism, and enlightenment have already been made and in much detail, and I don't want to rehearse these arguments in too much detail here. I will discuss some of these ideas with reference to Muslim politics soon. However, what I want to do right up front is to state that the challenge lies not just in recognizing that we need to be careful about reading European history onto other parts of the world, but in operationalizing that recognition. So how do we go from realizing that we shouldn't really do that to actually being able to work out theoretical concepts and frameworks by incorporating local dynamics as well? The hard part, at least today, lies not in the recognition that other contexts may have produced other modes of oppression and different languages of liberation, but in weaving within that the specific impact of Western histories and ideas. To understand the various ways in which secularization may take place in different contexts requires not a negation of the European experience, just a more precise containment of it. The hardest part, and the one that I will also try to talk about a bit later, is defining key terms. We continuously, and this goes back to Lois's question earlier, we still struggle with defining religion in a way that allows for meaningful comparison of religion and non-religion to take place. So let's start with the non-West. How do we separate the West from the non-West today? The colonial encounter was brutal in its impact on local epistemologies, categories, and modes of analysis. However, colonized societies responded with immense creativity, engaged with ideas and practices that came from the colonizers, modified them, reworked them, and actually also often shipped them back home as well. So colonizing societies also transformed as a result of this. And I'm thinking of a whole host of works, but something like Susan Buck Morse's work on the Haitian Revolution and how that influenced Hegel's and Hegel's ideas and how that impacted the French Revolution. There's a lot of work on how ideas about nationalism travel to the Indian context and how Indian nationalist practices, and maybe this is something that you have some idea about as well, but how those ideas and practices then influence working class politics within Britain. So there has been a continuous movement of ideas and practices. So regardless of the animosity and differences in power that undergirded this exchange, obviously the colonizers had much more power. But nevertheless, regardless of that, there was a rich and multifaceted exchange and dialogue that has been going on for several centuries now. And it has shaped important trajectories in both contexts. At the very least, it suggests ahistorical to work with essentialized nativist categories that have managed to preserve some intrinsic difference despite the ongoing centuries-long interaction. So in the case of Islam, a very easy example is that it's, you know, literature on Muslim politics, particularly literature on Muslim politics and secularism, is littered with statements like, I'm quoting, Homo Islamicus will always revert to type under all circumstances and regardless of the nature and depth of the historical change he may suffer or undergo. So the idea that somehow Muslims are more religious and will always stay more religious and have always been more religious, it forms, despite the huge variation and despite the fact that there has been all this interaction and also internal dynamics that have changed Muslim societies, there is this idea that somehow there is some core to this. Now, in a perceptive analysis, Navarro Yashin has argued that following Edward Said's influential work, Many who targeted the imposition of Western discourses and categories on Middle Eastern primarily Muslim societies, such as Mitchell and Abu Lahoud, and these are all people doing critical work, have risked reproducing essentialism, and I'm quoting, in leaving a precipitation of cultural authenticity or tradition underneath the layers of European costume, thereby overlapping by default with cultural revivalisms or nationalisms in the context studied, end quote. So Navarro Yashin suggests that in the case of Turkey, at least, it's not possible to distinguish between the Western and the native points of view, because there is no space where they have not been integrally and fundamentally and historically engaged with each other. Turks, Arabs, Muslims, and Jews, she argues, as do others, are Europe's internal and not external others. Just how internal, again, requires a bit of a rethinking both of history and geography. And this is a game that I play sometimes with my students. We take Europe to be a continent, and South Asia is a subcontinent. Now, how exactly is Europe a continent remains open to be seen, because you could easily argue that Europe is a subcontinent of Asia in terms of geographical space, in terms of the number of people, in terms of the diversity of languages, ethnicities. Europe is actually smaller than the subcontinent of Asia, of South Asia. So India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan, Sri Lanka together are actually bigger in terms of space. And the Mercator projection, which is what we use most often, actually reduces South Asia, and it actually expands places closer to the poles. So Little Britain appears much bigger. So there is that reimagining of both space and history that is required. The discourse about, you know, the Muslim presence in Europe actually ignores 700 years of continuous Muslim presence in Europe, which had a deep impact on what we call European Western political thought. And I'm thinking here, for instance, of the impact of Moorish Islam, the experience of living there, of living in Andalusia, before moving to Amsterdam. For Spinoza, one of the key thinkers and writers who's influential in our understandings of toleration, and a key term that he uses, acquiescentia, Ed Boglin and some others have argued, doesn't really translate very easily into any European language, but it does translate relatively easily into Arabic. So there is a way in which that influence has worked its way through European thought as well, or Western thought, and yet it remains under-recognized. Now, while the case is easier made for a place like Turkey than Pakistan for the way that there is no native core, I do agree with Navarro Yashin that it would be futile to search for an authentic native under the layers of Western influence. Yet I argue that there is some analytical use to the terms Western and non-Western, or Western and Muslim, if only because many within these societies believe there to be a difference. These differences do not stem from inherent essentialized characteristics, somehow common to, for instance, Muslims across different periods in history and in different parts of the world, living across with very different experiences of class and ethnicity, etc. But in fact, these differences stem from localized historical trajectories that operate in an interactive, though non-linear manner. The interactive, interdependent nature of cultural, political, and economic changes means that there is no native core to be separated from the Western, and yet there is a specific context to developments within what we call the Western and the non-Western world, that these categories do not contain identical societies. More importantly, I think following Marshall Hodgson, it's possible to argue that Western thought is more traditional in some ways. What we call Western thought is more traditional because it relies on the same philosophers, the same pieces and works of writings. The sense of rupture is less intense in Western thought. And this is not, you know, obviously there is a sense of rupture. The Enlightenment was a sense of was a kind of a rupture, and there are actually multiple Enlightenments as people like Sankaramuthu or William Connolly have argued. But this sense of rupture is less severe than the sense of rupture that was suffered by colonized societies, and I work on Muslim context specifically. So the loss of epistemologies, the loss of actually scholarly works, the loss of languages to engage with those scholarly works, etc., that sense is much more intense in many colonized societies. So in that sense, Europe is much more traditional because it actually relies on an ongoing body of work. And Charles Taylor's Magisterial Making of Modern Identity, for instance, also provides a glimpse into the sense of religious and philosophical continuity in Europe for the last several centuries. The West may now reside in and inform imaginaries around the world, but it draws its strength from a particular kind of universalism that rendered its parochial European origins invisible at one level. The tension between retaining a perspective on the difference between the Western and the non-Western, and particularly in my case, Western and Muslim, while also appreciating the layers of continuous interaction that make each of them what they are today, can be productive for both analytical and political purposes. An example of how they have been put to excellent use is the work by Roxanne Hugan. Her book, Enemy in the Mirror, is really quite an excellent piece of work in which she looks at, she carries out careful historical analysis and looks at how Enlightenment thought impacted some of the key Islamist thinkers, including Sayyid Qutb, Afghani, and Khomeini. These influences are an important part of the contextualization of the historical juncture at which Islamism arose. And elsewhere in my work, I've looked at the particular historical juncture at which Islamism arose, asking, you know, why does Islamism arise at this particular point and not any point earlier or later? Why does it arise towards the end of 19th, early 20th century? What is it that makes it possible for this innovation, which is Islamism, to arise? Now, within this larger project, Hugin also recognizes that the writings of many of the pillars of Western political philosophy, particularly the Greek philosophers, were saved and extensively commented upon during the Dark Ages by European Dark Ages by Arabs and Muslims. It is through the writings of Ibn Sina, Ibn Rushd, and Ibn Khaldun, among others, that the Greek writings that often form the basis of our discussions of democracy and secularism were reintroduced into European libraries some centuries later. In her attempts to illustrate this co-implication between Western and Islamist thought, Hugin is following Partha Chatterjee, who also suggests that the vocabulary available to colonized societies is very much defined by the experience of colonization and what we may call a Western experience. So what I've tried to do is, to some extent, complicate the relationship between the West and non-West, but also suggest that, in fact, it is not... It's not a Borgmeier of just sinking relativity and having no answer to the relationship between the West and non-West, but in fact that much more detailed, specific historical analysis needs to be part of our analysis to understand what exactly are the influences and how they may have worked together. Now let us move to look at how this rather long discussion about Western and non-Western impinges upon the construction of the category religion and or secular. Religion, non-religion, and secular are dependent upon each other. And the construction of the category of religion is quite important in how we conceptualize non-religion or secular. Historical experiences of religion in Europe colored how religion was conceived of in a place that I'm familiar with, in South Asia, certainly for official purposes since 1789. Colonial administrators in India were thrown off by the deceptive nature of religion. It was either everywhere or nowhere. In attempting to manage a very diverse societies, remember that this is, you know, 1789, we're talking about relatively religiously homogenous British India. So when the colonial administrators actually start wanting to manage India, are in a position to start managing India, British India was teeming with different languages, ethnicities, and religious practices. The administrators looked for familiar signposts. A script? Now, that was difficult. Hinduism did not have a clear script. Buddhism did not have a clear script. So they started defining scripts. They started picking up scripts that would be the scripts for these particular religions. Then some specific rituals. But what to make of Sufi shrines, which are frequented by people from across different religious groups, or Shia processions that are joined by pretty much anybody who happens to live on that street, again, without regard to religion? A priesthood. But how to work with this very scattered body of scholars, which was the ulama? I mean, there's no clear hierarchy. There is nobody like the Pope who actually has, or any, you know, or like the Anglican Archbishop who wields authority. There is no clear reason to move between one alim and the other. So, you know, they have their schools of thought. They all try to argue within that school of thought. They have certain structures of logic. But it's not really a priesthood, so what to do with that? And most importantly, some laws. Where are the laws defined by religion? And we actually don't find them in British India, and in Mughal India, we don't find them, and so the British started looking for laws that were defined by religion. Now, the story with laws is very interesting. At the initial stages of colonial rule, British administrators assumed that all Indians acted out of, and I'm quoting, inherent religiosity and orthodoxy, so that the codes of religious laws were sufficient to adjudicate in all situations and all crises, end quote. At the same time, they attributed to their own legal traditions principles of universal jurisprudence. This provided the backdrop to the persistent attempts at codification of Islamic and Hindu laws, binding their practice through the use of precedents and increasingly limiting their application to the point that in the early 20th century, religious law could rightly be called static and out of date. Thus, in the process of codification, what was dynamic and variegated was stunted so that it was of little use by the early 20th century. More critically, public matters and those of universal application were to be adjudicated by laws of an English provenance. The earliest British codifiers and reformers had indeed imagined, and I'm quoting, that India would be a mirror of England. Indian constituted the nemesis of English rationality, yet it was also the arena in which this new class of civil servants could fulfill its urge towards centralization and order. Indeed, while the general assumption is that Indian law was primitive compared to British law, this is simply not the case. Many reforms that were actually suggested for England and were not carried out in England were then initially, penal code reforms, etc., were actually first implemented in India because there was greater possibility of doing that there. So somebody like Squill, for instance, has looked at, has compared English legal system and Indian legal system at the time. English legal system was no more modern than the Indian one, and struggles to modernize the legal system in England were more easily realized in India, illustrating, and I'm quoting, that imperial powers were often able to do in their colonies what they were unable to do at home. Let's look at the case of Sharia in a bit more detail, because, again, that is something that is of contemporary concern as well. Sharia is not a set of laws. It's a set of guidelines for making decisions in particular situations. The Sharia embraces contradictory juridical decisions. There are, you know, four main schools of juridical norms, but in fact there is huge variation within them as well, and a multiplicity of juridical methods, insisting only that they be based on certain authentic sources and reasoned deduction. This crucial element of flexibility and multiplicity is often lost when the term Sharia is translated as the law of Islam, or even Islamic law. Rather, Sharia is a broad set of customs authenticated and sanctified by legal decisions. The principles and institutions of legal specialists who make such decisions, known as fiqh, should be actually understood as Islamic law. As an aside, I think I should also mention that fatwa, which is also of contemporary concern, the vast majority of fatwa are rulings with no enforcement mechanism behind them. And the vast majority of fatawa are actually rulings on personal matters. So people go to a scholar and say, I've had a fight with my wife, I want to divide our property, what's the best way for doing that? The scholar will give a ruling. Now it is my choice whether I want to follow that or not. People have also known to go fatwa shopping. But of course, there is also being over, and you know, this is something that the ulama will complain about, that people come to us, they get a fatwa, they don't like it, they go to another scholar and try and get another fatwa for them. But this is not to negate that there are situations where fatwa and these kinds of religious pronunciations can actually be held within community settings, can be imposed by force. But I'm just explaining that the large number of fatawa are actually not, A, not political, and B, without any enforcement mechanism behind them. Now, in any case, going back to our story, the British administrators were keen to contain Sharia. You know, this whole business about having a set of guidelines rather than a set of laws was too complicated. So they wanted to contain it to a known universe of precedents and laws rather than guidelines. Moreover, to these administrators, the idea of a unified religion was closely linked to legal codification. Not surprisingly, legal codification and homogenization, important for the modern state's effective administration, was introduced in India by the British administration in a manner that was shot through with their own assumptions and perceptions. The contradiction and looseness of Indian textual and customary judicial practices remained a source of anxiety for early colonial administrators, such that authoritative compilations that would not just represent, but also rationalize and reconstruct Indian jurisprudence were commissioned. And one of my colleagues in the history department at King's College, John Wilson, has looked at how early British jurists actually erased out contradictory opinions and picked up opinions that worked well with their conceptions of, you know, how society should be run, and made that a compilation. So one of the very, very famous ones is William Macnaghten, who compiled the principles and precedents of his Mohammedan law in early colonial administration. And he, in his foreword, actually says that his compilation was intended to fix the many areas, and I'm quoting, where a contrariety of opinions has hitherto prevailed, to allow a clear determination of the case at hand. The emphasis then was not just on recording, but rationalizing and homogenization. Sharia had been practiced on a diversified, subjective, and localized interpretation in India. Due to their anxieties as rulers and the precariousness of their rule, the company and colonial administrators started a process of codification as early as in the 18th century. However, the very process of such codification meant that certain views were excluded and others highlighted, distortions magnified by the interests of the administration and lack of knowledge among the administrators. Most critically, what was fluid and context-specific became increasingly static and universal. The purpose of the discussion is in part to destabilize the historical narrative of the rigidity of religion at all times in all spaces. So that's one purpose, but also to think about the master category, religion. And let me come to that now. I draw heavily upon Talal Asad's seminal work in realigning our understanding of the secular along with the religious as analytic categories. Asad's unique contribution is to suggest that our concept of secular cannot operate outside of our understanding of the idea of religion. So how we conceive of religion will impact how we understand the secular. But more interestingly, I think for me, is that Asad also made me realize, and it seemed to me that I wasn't the only one, it was new to most people as well, that secularism and secularization is actually not really a one-time process. The relationship between the secular and the religious is actually an ongoing dialectical one. While commenting on the standard model of secularization that I'll talk about a bit later, Asad points out that the interesting thing about this view is that although religion is regarded as alien to the secular, the latter is also seen to have generated religion. Historians of progress relate that in the pre-modern past, secular life created superstitious and oppressive religion, and in the modern present, secularism has produced enlightened and tolerant religion. Thus, the insistence on a sharp separation between the religious and the secular goes with the paradoxical claim that the latter continuously produces the former. So, in his attempts at regulating religious influence in the public sphere, the state cannot help but impinge upon the formation of subjectivities, norms, and standards. In this and in his previous work, Genealogies of Religion, Asad has gone beyond the criticism of Eurocentric notions of secularization raised by many others. It's not just that our notions of secularization derive essentially from a European experience that was then universalized, etc. What is critical to our study of Islam and other non-Western religious interactions is also the definition of religion that we use. how do we define religion? Because how we define secular is linked intrinsically to how we define religion. As I have discussed briefly earlier, colonial administrators in Britain looked for certain types of religion. And not only did they find that religion, you know, they made that religion happen, but in fact Indians found it too. And by that I mean that we see a gradual process of transformation within indigenous religious thought and practice towards the primacy of script, towards the definition of specific kinds of rituals, and the attempt of creating a religion in the mold of the European one. This argument is specifically often made in the context of Hinduism, that there were hugely variegated practices. There was no conception of this, you know, meta religion, Hinduism. And in fact, through the late 18th century onwards, we see actually a process where Hinduism as a religion was constructed. Certain scripts were chosen, certain hierarchies were frozen into place, certain laws were defined, certain practices were defined, and the idea of Hinduism was actually consolidated. So Asad goes on to argue that there cannot be a universal definition of religion, not only because its constituent elements and relationships are historically specific, but because the definition itself is a product of historical processes. Moreover, religion, and I think this is to me most interesting in terms of what he says, religion consists not of particular ideas, attitudes, or practices, but also, most critically, of followers. And we tend to often, in our discussions, forget the followers. To discover how the followers instantiate, repeat, alter, adapt, argue over, and diversify practices, ideas, and attitudes in relation to traditions of religion is a key step in understanding how religion may be, how religion generally or a religion may be secularized in different places at different times. To say all this is not to say that relativity is the new god, all is relative, perhaps the best thing for us is to leave everybody to what they're doing. I'm absolutely not arguing for that. To the contrary, I'm arguing for a much more serious engagement with what seems different, to try and understand precisely how it is different, whether it is different, and why do we understand it to be different. I understand, and I got to this point of writing this, and I thought, well, this sounds really wishy-washy. I use Asad's definition of religion, and then I don't say what I think about religion. So let me say how I understand religion. I understand a religion as a set of vocabularies and traditions that allow humans a vision of transcendence beyond their everyday lives. So like Asad, I am not suggesting that there is no continuity in religion. It's not that religions can be continuously reinterpreted and completely modified. There is a central core vocabulary and a vocabulary of traditions. Those traditions, however, are open to pulling up or, importance or lack of importance to reinterpretation and re-understanding at specific times and periods. One interesting tradition, for instance, in the Islamic context is the term jihad and a whole body of literature and practices and ideas related to it. And in the South Asian context, we see recent historical work has looked at how the term jihad had very different connotations. For several centuries, it was actually not important in political, public, and even spiritual discourse. It comes up in different ways, in different contexts. So the term is there, and obviously it plays a role, but it plays different roles in different contexts. So now to, how much time do I have? Who's keeping time? 10 minutes. Okay. I'll try to be quick. So now to secularism and secularization. I can be quite quick because. So in my book, I was interested in thinking about the relationship between secularism and secularization. I wasn't initially interested in it. I was interested in other things, but I ended up thinking about the relationship between secularism and secularization. And the two key theoretical insights that I highlight in the book are one, that in the vast bodies of literature on secularism and secularization, secularism in political science mostly, but some sociology, secularization in sociology primarily, we don't actually really have a conceptual map for the relationship between secularism, the ideology or the state project, and secularization, the social process. What is the relationship between the two? Does secularism have to be in place to lead to secularization, or does secularization has to have happened for secularism to be adopted? What exactly is the relationship between the two? And actually, if you look at history generally, but European history in particular, and one of the projects that I was involved in with Gareth Stedman-Jones and Ira Katz-Nelson looked at the variation in secularization within different contexts, in the European context, actually, within different countries in the European context. And actually, we find this huge variation in secularization. It's not a linear process, and sometimes it comes with secularism, sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes secularization of a kind happens and then it is reversed, so it's not a linear process. But recognizing this lack of clear relationship between secularism and secularization, I think, is quite critical. The second thing that I highlight is the fact that for too long, our understanding and analysis of secularization has had a kind of a quantitative focus. We've tried to look at the difference between more and less religion, you know, more and less visible religiosity, more or less church attendance, etc. And we haven't really looked at the quantitative change that secularization entails. And so Weber's work, for instance, that is quite influential, but nevertheless actually was somehow sidelined in some of its key implications, looks at how the Protestant Reformation actually led to a qualitative change. The Protestant reformers were actually not asking for less religion, they were asking for more religion. They thought that the Catholic cycle of sin and repentance wasn't enough, and actually you needed a whole life of, you know, really full of religiosity. And actually that requirement for more religion actually led to a qualitative change in how religion, it led to an objectification, homogenization, rationalization, a different kind of religious thought and practice. And so the question that I raise in my book, and I'm only going to raise it here because I don't have enough time to actually persuade you of my answer, but the question that I raise is whether we can think of the Islamists as actually facilitating a kind of secularization. The answer, I think, is partly to do with the fact that groups that may be facilitating secularization don't necessarily have to own up to the ideology of secularism, to the project of secularism. Because, as I discussed earlier, we don't exactly know what the relationship between secularism and secularization may be. At least the possibility is open that people, groups that are actually against secularism may actually be inadvertently facilitating secularization. But very quickly, and I can talk about the Islamists in my favorite subject in lots of detail later on. If people have questions, I'd be happy to go into that. I carried out archival work, but also 13 months of ethnographic work with two Islamist parties in urban Pakistan, Jamaat-e-Islami and Jamaat-e-Dawa. And I'm happy to talk about this in more detail later on. But what I want you to do very quickly before I end is to think about the category of non-religion here, particularly in relationship to secularism. Now, quite interestingly, there is no term for secularism in Urdu. The Islamists that I interacted with, particularly lower or middle-level activists, and again, my interest was actually not in spending time with the leadership, which, you know, everybody who goes on to research Islamists tends to spend time either with the leaders or looking at the work of the ideologues who are long dead. I was interested in understanding what current people, especially at the lower and middle level, what exactly are they thinking, how do they interpret, how do they rework these ideas, etc. And so the lower and middle level activists that I interacted with would use the English term secularism, but they would often use it interchangeably with Ladiniyat, which is a term that Simone also spoke about, and Dehriyat. Ladiniyat is a state of being without religion. Dehriyat is quite close to atheism. Now, the story is a bit more complicated because Ladiniyat is a state of being without religion, but it's also Deen is exactly not the same thing as religion. A deeni life is a life suffused with religiosity, perhaps spirituality, but not necessarily ritual. It's an attitude, it's a perspective, it is not necessarily religious practice per se. That many previously colonized societies saw secularism either as an end to their way of life or to the imposition of a particularly Christian way of life is not without reason. Van der Weer, among others, have looked at how not just the notion of a civilizing mission, but a very Christian view of religion and thus secularism drove colonial policies. Contemporary Islamist equation of secularism, an English term that is used widely in Urdu, with non-religion has something to do with those colonial histories. But also, it has something to do with older associations of deen versus dunya. Dunya is this world, the ideal person is one who can carry both deen and dunya together, somehow who is somebody who is able to manage religion without being too religious. At first glance, the term dunya seems to be very close to saeculum, the Latin term from which the word secular derives from. Indeed, it seems also close to the meaning that George Holyoake, the man credited with coining the term secular, was keen to promote. George Holyoake was keen to distinguish secular from the atheist or the non-believer. In his 1854 lecture, which was later published, he wrote, and I'm quoting, "Secularists consider free thinking as a double protest, as a protest against speculative error and in favor of specific moral truth. The term secularism has not been chosen as a concealment or as a disguise or as an apology for free inquiry, but as expressing a certain positive ethical element which the terms infidel, atheist, skeptic do not address." End quote. That's the term secularism. So what I'm trying to say, and I'll kind of wrap up quickly, is that secularism and secular is an importation. These terms and these ideas are an importation in the South Asian context, but have been taken up and have been reworked. But local equivalents of non-religiosity and a-religiosity, different from infidel, atheist, and secular, also have existed and have existed for much longer. Anyway, non-religion as a category runs into the problem that its existence seeks the erasure of the category that it needs to exist. Much like the West in the non-West, the religion in the non-religion refuses to be denied its place. In raising the possibility that the Islamists may be inadvertently facilitating secularization, the suggestion is not that the Islamists are wittingly supporting secularization or that they can be seen as liberals or progressives. Their attempt is not apologetic in its intention either. It's not that they are ultimately like us. The imagined polity and citizen of Islamist secularization are likely to be extremely different from the products of secularization in other contexts. In suggesting that non-Western, non-religion may accept the continued presence of religion as a condition of its own presence, I am again not trying to deny the validity of an opposite approach to this issue. The larger implication of this research and some of the observations I share here lie in recognizing the current limits of social and political theory, in appreciating the differences that arise from localized historical trajectories, and attempting to theorize about them in ways that would allow these differences to be acknowledged. Islamism's challenge to social science theorizing is no less significant for its obliqueness. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here.